Hey everyone, we are back minus Shula, so that always makes for an interesting podcast.
And a ratings bonanza.
And a ratings. We have noticed our downloads go up exponentially when Shula's not around.
Sans Shula.
And we can use words like exponentially because you know, we don't have to explain it to him either. But we are back with a little bit of a recap of the first two rounds of the NCAA tournament, looking at the bracket competition as well. Big props to Peter Tuckwell, who is flying along at the moment on top of this thing.
He's
done well with the Talking Split crew.
It's a very good guessing.
Not so great by our under-16 Vic Metro men's head coach, Don Lanossier, who is currently holding up the other end of the table, which isn't ideal. But there is one saving grace. Everyone will beat Justin Shula.
That's what happens when you don't press enter when you submit your bracket.
It's less than ideal by him, so... Definitely a worst of the week goes to Justin Shula, closely followed by Mike Zeppel, who didn't quite understand the rules of the tiebreaker, it'd be fair to say, when picking his bracket.
Moral of the story is read the instructions properly when filling in the bracket, and it's definitely not a soccer bracket. It was a basketball bracket asking for a basketball score, so 4 will not get it done, Robbie.
It will not, but on the bright side, Virginia is no longer in the competition anyway, so not something you need to worry about.
Do we want to start there?
I think so.
Obviously, you know, without stating the obvious, major upset. I think the most interesting thing about the whole thing that it was a 20-point difference.
Smash
in the
it.
End. So... upset, of course it's an upset, but as coach said after the game, just thoroughly outplayed.
Yep.
For the entire game. And
that was such a classy press conference afterwards as well.
He was
phenomenal. Bennett did a great job of giving credit to the other team. He didn't sit there and stick the boot into his kids. He still wanted to recognise that they had a great year despite the score, but gave absolute credit to Baltimore. That was huge.
And that's the product of a one and done competition where you go into it thinking that anything can happen before you even take the floor. So I'm sure that's in the back of the mind of not just the Virginia kids, but kids in every team, that this could be our run to the Final Four. Interesting game. I mean, that's there's a lot of talk in the media and basketball analysts about the pack line and how it's sustainable through March. I don't think that's the major issue. The major issue for them was just that the other team made shots and played really well, and that's what happens.
Bad matchup.
That might have been a bad matchup for them, but obviously losing one of their better players the week before to a fractured wrist or thumb didn't help them either. So what it did do was just open up that top left side of the bracket unbelievably.
Huge. Kentucky. Coach Cal, it's worked out for him again. He has some serious pull in the coaching world, it would appear, in the college level, but... you got to think Kentucky now are fairly strong favourites to get all the way through to a Final Four berth.
It's an interesting quadrant up there. Kansas State, Kentucky, you got Loyola, Chicago and Nevada. Just the who's of not who's of college basketball. Kentucky sitting there with three other programs. They're obviously the favourite to come out of that section. But like we know, anything can happen.
And some great coaches in that little quadrant too. Coach Cal, obviously, Bruce Weber, Eric Musselman. And Sister Jean.
Jean, she is
I'm
the
assuming
head,
she's the head coach of that Loyola Chicago.
Coach. She is the one getting the most media attention. That's a great story. 98-year-old Chaplin who has them losing this week in her bracket. She has told the team, which is very, very funny. But
it's not a good sign for them, unfortunately. She's been pretty good so far.
But they've played unbelievably well. They've beaten two teams that have consistently... Miami and Tennessee were in top 25 pretty much all year. Miami's got NBA players. Tennessee looks like a football team out there. Those dudes are just so thick and athletic. For them to win those two games, this is a thought. Imagine if they did not win their conference tournament. Say they lost on the buzzer in their conference tournament. They would not have got an automatic selection.
Yep.
They would not have then been invited to the NCAA tournament. And they absolutely belong. They've got some sensational players out there. But it's just an interesting thought when you see these teams make their runs and they actually can miss out. They did a good job winning the Missouri Valley, but it's close to whether you make it or not.
Absolutely. And sucks they knocked out Melbourne's own DJ. Dijan Vasiljevic
played well, made a few shots.
He did
made
well.
A few shots, and that was a great finish too. Friday it morning, was. That catch and shoot three, right on, pretty much right on the buzzer, got that done for him. So,
So there's been a couple of good finishes. Like, we moved down to the bottom part of that bracket as well. Like, Michigan had a massive win on the bell. Like,
that was on the bell.
There was no time left on that thing rolling Houston. Yeah. That was a huge win by then. Contested, falling out of court. Not entirely sure they could see the rim as they stuck that thing, but got to win the game.
Absolutely.
Shot goes in.
Absolutely. And, you know, 3.5 seconds, they went from baseline to catch and shoot in rhythm. You know, we talk about being prepared for things throughout the pod. We've talked about having a plan for certain parts of the game. Inbounder from the end line to try and get a catch and shoot three is absolutely something that you should have a little bit of a plan for.
Yep.
Defensively, who knows what they're going to do defensively, but for them to get the ball to the kid on the run who then flipped it over his shoulder to someone lifting up across the sideline was really cool and great finish. And that's what March is, isn't it?
Oh, it is. It's the best time of year for this sort of stuff. So who do you like coming out of this bracket? Because I'll sort of look at this and very much emphatically on board the fact that North Carolina got rolled yesterday.
Yep.
Like, I'm a big fan of that because it upsets Justin.
Sure, yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. That upsets Justin. We are on the same page there.
And friend of the show, Pete Lonergan, is a UNC boy as well. I have a little bit more time for Lono than I do Justin, as it turns out. But either way, happy they're out of the tournament. Like, so from my end, no problems. I'm pretty much on that Gonzaga bandwagon. I think from this point to come out of that bracket, I probably would have been on Xavier before now, but I think it's Gonzaga.
I think my busted bracket did have Xavier. But the Zags, they're unbelievable. When you look at the kids that they now are able to recruit, they recruit nationally recruited players. Like, they're not just beating out West Coast schools or mid-major. They're beating out everybody to get these kids. The Norvell Jr. kid had a day out against Ohio State at 28 and 11 and made 6 threes, and he's a freshman, which is unbelievable. What's unbelievable is that I believe he redshirted last year.
Okay.
So for 12 months, he was just on campus training, practicing strength and conditioning, and it kind of helped, and he didn't play a game for 12 months. But he,
a lot to be said for extra training.
He committed to player development, which we'll talk about in a couple of minutes. I love watching Gonzaga play. Really enjoy watching Michigan play as well. John Beilein does an unbelievable job.
Fantastic.
Getting his teams better through the year.
Yeah.
So the
defensively, they're outstanding.
Well, this year, yeah. So I read a story. They hired they have a new assistant coach came in who is a bit of a defensive guru. So they put a bit of an emphasis on becoming a better defensive team. The awesome thing with Michigan is the team that they have on November 15 for opening night is so far removed from the team they have on March 15, and that's a credit to their player development, but also just, you know, the continual improvement of the team. So the Zags, Michigan, I think the Zags, you think about them, lost last year in the championship game, you know, tied ball game 2 minutes to go. Could it be the year of redemption for the Zags?
Quite possibly. And they lost three major players last year. Like, Karnowski was massive for those guys last year. And they've managed to come back with just as good a team this year. Yep. I think that's a great lesson to a lot of teams, is that you've got to take the long-term plan as well. You can't just plan for 1 year and ahead. And a lot of these colleges do get sucked into that one-and-done type mentality as well, where they love the talent. But you need to plan 2 or 3 years out, because you look at some of the teams that cause upsets in this tournament, and it's usually the upperclassmen, or those schools with the upperclassmen, like the seniors and the juniors, that can do some damage this time of year.
Absolutely. So you've got, and that's a really good point, you've got teams that have are loaded with juniors and seniors who have been on campus for 3 going on 4 years. They've gone through extended player development. They've been in the system for 3 or 4 years, so you don't have to teach all the way from the start every year, so you can just start building on and layering content. And that's kind of part of the recipe for having a run in March when you are the mid-major, is a junior and senior laden team who have gotten better and are now comfortable playing with each other.
All right, we move on to the East. This is where I actually have a little bit of green left in my bracket. I think the only game I missed was the Wichita State one, which I'm pretty comfortable with Marshall. But there's a great game coming up in this part of the bracket. I love this Villanova West Virginia
game.
Full
disclosure, Robbie, the bracket on my fridge does have West Virginia winning the whole thing. Not the one online, but I love West Virginia. Purely because a bit of that, juniors and seniors on the team, they are out of their mind defensively. They play so hard. Now, Javon Carter is a star. There's there's a great little video floating around cyberspace of Bobby Huggins talking about how he first saw Javon Carter play, and it was 8 a.m. It was an AAU tournament in wherever, and he's drinking his coffee trying to wake up, and there's this kid on the far, far court, just like full court pressing dudes at 8 a.m. And he said, that's my guy. So it was, I think that is a brilliant matchup. Villanova, a lot of the international basketball style of play can be found in what they do. How does the West Virginia athleticism and defensive intensity and pressure affect that? That's going to be a great, great game.
And I know you spoke about it yesterday as well, Mike. Villanova are just basic. Like, there's nothing complex about them. Basic. They have some little tweaks, some little counters to what they run normally, but it's not 85 different offenses with a counter for everything. It's just we'll run three or four really basic things and we'll get them really good. And it's hard to guard.
Very similar. Like, they're not recruiting McDonald's All-Americans by any stretch, but they have guys leave the program as NBA players. So player development, again, really big for them. They're so fundamental. Those guys understand the value of being able to shoot the ball.
Yep.
And if you can't shoot the ball, you impact what they do. So you'll always have at least four, and if their post player can shoot as well, then you'll have five guys on the floor who are ready to catch and shoot that thing.
Yep.
The other game there, Texas Tech and Purdue, that's also going to be pretty good. Purdue's stiff with big fella Haas going out with a fractured elbow, so it'll be interesting to see what they do. I know he tried to play.
He tried to play
on the weekend. NCAA said no, so we'll see if they can get a clearance on that elbow brace or guard or whatever he was trying to wear. So it'll be very interesting. Chris Beard done a phenomenal job with Texas Tech. Like 5 years ago, he was a Division II coach. So in 5 years, he's gone from Angelo State in Texas, D2, went and did a really good job with Arkansas State in the Sun Belt, parlayed that into this Texas Tech job where they've had arguably the best season in the history of the school. So
absolutely, three seed coming in. Well, that's pretty big for those guys. I don't know if they've ever been as high as a three seed.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't have thought so. And they've got a real chance of knocking off Purdue and getting to that Elite Eight this weekend.
Yep. And that's probably the portion of the bracket, I think, that top right, that's probably the most normal. It's probably only Marshall that's really caused some big upsets in there. But other than that, that's pretty much played out as you expected.
Should look
it
right
to.
There, Robbie.
Yeah,
well,
there's
look.
A bit of green in my bracket on that part. It's unfortunately not so much in the bottom right, where my Michigan State boys did exactly what I thought they might do and come in with a very good team and have been bundled out by the Syracuse zone.
We'll talk a little bit about the zone in a minute, Robbie, but that was an interesting game. Really interesting. I watched it yesterday morning, and just the clunkiness fit right into what Syracuse was trying to do. And, you know, we've all been in those games as a player or a coach where everything you try does not work, and all of a sudden you're down three with 45 seconds to go. It's like, how'd we get here?
Yep.
And I think that was that game yesterday for Michigan State.
Well, I woke up yesterday morning, had a meeting offsite, cursed myself for putting a meeting on when Michigan State were playing, walked out of the meeting, saw that was a loss, and thought, you know what, probably a pretty good decision to not go back and watch this one.
Yeah.
This is,
But,
you know, it's Boeheim had to play the playing game, get two big scalps straight away, and now it's Duke-Syracuse, the battle of the zones.
I think it's, you know, validation of how hard it is to prepare for a zone in 48 hours. How hard it is to prepare for that length as well. For a lot of teams, Michigan State can simulate it. A lot of teams can't simulate that in practice. What's also interesting is, so Michigan State in the Big Ten, how many zones do they actually face during the year is a really interesting thing. I remember reading a lot about the old Big East, so, you know, the Villanovas, Georgetown, Pittsburgh back in the day, how comfortable they got playing against Syracuse because they saw it twice a year.
Yep.
So over the course of 4 or 5, 6 years, coaches and coaching staffs and systems got used to the zone, so they were able to kind of play against it and set things up for it. If you don't play zone all year and you come into the round of 32,
you have no idea what you're doing.
It's going to be very, very difficult for 18, 19-year-old kids especially.
Absolutely. So the other big game in that one, I mean, I've got Kansas coming out of this one against Clemson.
Yep.
And the other game in that one, like, Kansas have looked fairly comfortable all the way through. I don't think they've really been challenged too much at this point. They haven't shot the ball particularly well from the perimeter, so whoever they come up against, they're going to see zone. If they win this first one, they're going to need to shoot the ball well, and I suppose there's a little bit of style of play, as you're touching on the zone as well. It's teams are relying on the three-point shot to get out of zones.
Absolutely. Bill Self's done a fantastic job. They've got some really good guards over at Kansas. Traditionally play three guards and two post players, and this year has changed his style of play and his, not his philosophy, but more so his style of play for more a four-guard, one-post lineup. And their posts are super athletic and, you know, run that floor really, really well. So I think Kansas has done a fantastic job. The bottom part of that bracket is the Duke-Syracuse game itself.
Yep.
And Duke smacked Syracuse a couple of weeks ago.
Comfortably
yeah. smacked them. So that'll be interesting to see what tweaks Syracuse make to their zone. Does Duke shoot the ball as good as what they did last time around? And all of a sudden, you know, Sweet 16, you got freshmen playing in the game. How does that also play into that? So it's going to be the battle of the Duke zone versus the battle of the Syracuse zone. What we got, first to 45, yeah. first to 50.
Is that good basketball to watch or not good basketball? I mean, there's a part of me that does appreciate seeing team zone and watching the offense try and break that thing down as well. And Duke's got some dudes here that can do that. You know, Bagley obviously is a great post target for these guys. Grayson Allen can hit as well. Like, it is an interesting matchup seeing two teams that play fairly similar styles come in here.
Isn't it interesting? And it's probably a really good lesson for all of us coaches here in Melbourne and Australia, is Coach K has, for however many years, 30 years, been a man-to-man coach, sprinkled in the smallest part of zone, but he sensed halfway through this year that zone was the only way that they were going to get it done. Now, remember that Boeheim was an assistant on his Basketball USA team, so he'd been pretty intimate in watching Boeheim teach the zone at camps and on tours and things like that. I just think it's something, you know, you got to have a really good awareness of your group, and he obviously saw that he was not going to be able to teach those freshmen or get those freshmen to a point where they were going to be able to defend the ball in a man-to-man situation well enough to give them a chance. What he does have is 6'9", 6'10", 6'11", all over the floor.
Yep.
So I guess a bit of that's swallowing your own pride as well. And I know you hear coaches all the time say, I'm a man-to-man coach, and you know, we look at other styles and maybe we don't appreciate it for what it can do to help us as well. And I was someone that never played in a zone. Like, we never zoned. I can't remember ever sitting in a 2-3 zone ever. But that should not impact what will get it done for my team. And just because I've never did it or haven't got an affinity to it, you know, that should not play into it.
Definitely. So, I mean, I've looked a lot at the Boeheim zone with Syracuse over the years and the championship production stuff that he put out as well on how to teach it and what's good about it. And I love how he teaches it. Like, it's a big, aggressive zone. It's not just that we're going to stand in a 2-3 and we're just going to sit here and hope that you miss. Yeah. Like, it is an aggressive trapping. They get after it. They cause all sorts of problems, just different alignments with it as well, right, where they put them on the floor. It's a great watch. And his thing is, well, you know, stick with it. Like, they're not going to pick you apart on everything every time. You know, we're going to play the percentages a little bit, but we're going to take you out of what you like to run as well. Because, I mean, realistically, how many times do you get your team straight away and you put in a man-to-man offense?
Correct.
It's the first thing that goes in, right, rather than something that'll work both ways, where works against man, works against zone.
Right.
I think that's really valuable.
And you said it, like, disruption. They don't just stand around in a 2-3. And Duke doesn't either. They don't just stand around in a 2-3. There are opportunities and triggers that set off double teams, or, you know, set off hedges or stunts, or, you know, whatever it is. So I think that's the important part, is when you watch that game this week, where's the disruption come from? Sorry.
Yep. So I think that's probably a nice little segue into something we're looking at doing probably next term, I think it is, on the podcast, where we probably go do a little bit of a Facebook live show and talk about zones and zone offenses, because it is something we can talk about here, obviously, but not something that you're probably going to pick up a lot on a podcast. But if we can do a little bit of diagramming as well, I think that might be something that's pretty handy for
little coaches. X's and O's special, Robbie.
It will be. So
interesting. I got a few takeaways from last weekend, Robbie. Now, we spoke about it being the most unproductive week of the work year, and that held true. It was the most unproductive 4 days of the year. Here are some of the things that I took out of the weekend, and I think just, you know, for some food for thought things. The first one, I'd like to claim it was my own, but it's stolen. But we just spoke about the zone and how much these college teams are struggling playing against the zone. Like, it is really, it jumps out on TV. Like,
every time.
Like, how many contested twos, turnovers, deflected passes when the offensive team is up against 2-3, 3-2, or sort of a little bit of 1-3-1 as well. is that a result of us now as a basketballing culture teaching the three, it's three-pointer or it's layup, and there's nothing in between? If I'm running a zone, and a lot of zone teachers will tell you, well, we will give you the short corner, we'll give you the mid post, you know, the hash mark just below the elbow, we'll give you the foul line, and you're going to have to make it work from there. What we won't give you is, we don't want to give you rhythm threes, we don't want to give you paint touches, we don't want to give you baskets at the rim, but we'll give you the mid-range. Now, we don't teach the mid-range anymore, Robbie. No, we don't teach the pull-up. We don't
discuss this, I think.
We don't teach the elbow catch and, you know, reverse pivot and jumper from the elbow, because analytically now, we've spoken about that a couple of weeks ago, it's not worth as much as the corner three. So I think just interesting in how much do the struggles of the athletes versus the zone play into us maybe not teaching the mid-range game as much anymore.
And I think it's valuable with your fours and fives in particular. They're going to play in that zone. They need to be able to take a step or two off the block and be able to hit that and be a threat out there, because if you can be a threat in a short corner or just on the wing, someone's going to have to come out and guard you.
Mm.
If you can't stick that shot, they're just going to pack that thing in and hope for the best.
Right.
You're no threat to anyone. Right. So I think it is valuable that we do teach bigs in particular to, okay, now start getting some range. Now that you can do mic and drill and make 50 in a row and those sorts of things, now start getting a little further out, get some square ups, as well as just ball reversals are the big things against that zone too. Like, hit that high post and skip the ball onto the other side of the floor.
Absolutely.
Like, get the zone overloaded and then be able to play off the other side as well is something we've seen a lot against zones.
And yeah, and just think about the looks that you would get on a skip pass. You're attacking a late closeout, so it's a one dribble pull up to the baseline. Probably doesn't get coached or taught or preached as much anymore. A lot of the time to beat the zone, a lot of coaches speak about putting your best player in the middle of the zone, your most creative playmaker. You know, are they also developing their mid-range abilities to be proficient from there? So I think it was a really good point. Love to claim it as my own, but I won't. But just interesting food for thought there, Robbie. The amount of contested twos late clock across the weekend was staggering. The amount of times the clock would get to, not low, but took 9, 8, and the ball would just get dribbled on the spot. I think it was a really good lesson in 9 seconds is still a lot of time. The Europeans do a fantastic job of 9 seconds, 8 seconds on the clock, spread the floor. If you have not got the best athlete on the floor with the ball, it's hard to get a blow by, considering a lot of teams play pack line now, or, you know, they're not proficient at keeping the ball in front. I don't think late clock is an excuse for settling for a contested two.
No, not at all. And you do see a lot of teams just bring that on ball up when it's sort of 9 seconds and say create. I think the big thing we've got to be teaching our athletes at a junior level is get separation off the on ball as well.
Right.
Like, if you don't get far enough away from that and you sprint out of the on ball or you sprint off that on ball, you're just going to be in the same spot, especially with a lot of teams now switching on balls late in clock. And you look at some of the athletes that are playing in this tournament, it's like, well, they have no problem staying in front with length. While they may not be great on foot speed, but their length alone will be able to contest everything they need to contest. So I think late clock is a really interesting point.
It seems to be magnified late clock, late game. Yep. Like the last 3 minutes up against the short shot clock seems worse than 16 minutes to go in the first half. Like, I think that was better than late clock, late game. And again, you're dealing with nervous 18, 19-year-old kids who have to now make decisions. But the better teams and the teams that are going to win these games will make better decisions.
The D is trying to speed them up, obviously, too. Like, with a 30-second shot clock, that becomes really difficult to get the ball back if you're down. So they are doing everything they possibly can to try and speed the offense up a little bit more and trying to play with pressure and double teams coming at you and be able to make the extra pass and take some time off that clock as well is difficult to do. So. I think it's a really valuable point that we can actually use at the VJBL level too.
Absolutely, absolutely. Third one, Robbie, is these mid-major so-called upsets. Not so much upsets anymore because they happen every year. So we should not be calling them upsets. But look at these teams. Buffalo got a win. Loyola Chicago got a win. Nevada has got wins. Gonzaga keeps winning. Who else we got? We've got Butler. Have moved into a high major conference, but traditionally a mid-major. Marshall got themselves wins. Rhode Island got themselves a win. This is a product of having junior and senior laden teams, but they have really put in player development programs that the athletes commit to. The other part to it is that all these guys have workout guys where they go home in the summer and they try to transform their game. And I think it's a really good lesson for a lot of our coaches and juniors is that it does not take more than a summer for you to take your game to another level. Like those 3 or 4 months over the summer over there, over here it's November, December, January, February. Those 3 to 4 months are critical if you want to add a layer to your game, upskill on something that maybe you're not as proficient on. That's what these mid-rate major teams do, because they know they're not going to beat out the blue chippers for the athlete.
They're never going to have the A-quality talent, I suppose, but a good team will always win in those situations too. If they can go for, you know, 7-8 guys deep, whereas some of these other schools are going, hey, our starting five is pretty good, but then our bench, not so much. I mean, we saw the difference that Virginia group made when they lost their sixth man. Correct, all of a sudden, their scoring goes down, and they're not a heavy scoring team anyway, but they lose a big part of their offense. That can be a massive difference in teams, and I mean, it's a bit of a throwaway line, but players are made in the offseason.
Absolutely.
It's, you can't just go away and do nothing and get a break. It's, you've got to go and add something else, and if you're a great post player, good, add a good mid-range or add a good three or something. You know, just add something to your game every time, because you'll get an opportunity with that as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely, mate. And the last one, this was interesting. This was a discussion point in the office yesterday. With the new FIBA intentional foul rules, how that will get officiated internationally is different to what we see on in the college game. So if I'm up three, defending the inbound, and they need three to tie with, say, 7 seconds to go, that ball comes in, kid takes one dribble, and we just automatically foul and send them to the foul line. So we're up three, they can make two from the foul line, we're still up one, so we play the time and score game across 7 seconds. The chips are stacked in my favor, absolutely, in that case. In Australia or internationally with FIBA rules, how is that going to get officiated? How unsportsmanlike or how intentional is it? Intentional? The theory is that we're always going to be up if we make free throws and send you to the foul line. So that's an interesting one to see how that plays in. I know it's not done a lot here in terms of game management, but at the higher level, like at a national championships, potentially would be Siebel, potentially would be Big V. It'd just be interesting to see how that gets officiated here.
And the reassuring part for all our listeners is that the referees didn't know either. We asked Bill Milden Hall and he gave us nothing. Effectively, we've come out of that conversation lesser for having been in part of it. There's a little bit of Billy Madison about Bill's response, absolutely, unfortunately. So it is something to certainly be mindful of. How do you feel about this tournament? Would you rather see all the number one, number two seeds in this, or are you happy to see some of the smaller schools in this? Like, there's a part of me that says, hey, it's great to see some of these smaller schools in there and winning games, but there's a big part of me that says, well, you know what? I don't want that.
It is,
I want to see the best teams play against each
other. It is interesting. I think for fanfare and for, you know, the product on TV to the casual passer, it's pretty cool. Yep. Like, to see the upsets, to see the buzzer beaters, absolutely. There is a massive part of me that does want to see this weekend Virginia play against Arizona or Virginia play against Kentucky. I do want to see Xavier and Gonzaga. I don't want to see Florida State and Gonzaga. You know, I want to see North Carolina and Michigan. Like, you want to see the blue chippers, the blue bloods play in this tournament. You know, Michigan State, Duke. That would have been awesome.
Would have been fantastic.
So there is a part of me that kind of wishes that I would have been able to see that this weekend instead of, say, Kansas State playing. But that is a part of the tournament.
So how would you feel about potentially a VJBL-type tournament that incorporated all of this? So if we said, just for argument's sake, VC, so there's 20 teams there, VJL1, VJL2, so you're up to, what, 40 teams,
yep.
VJL3 and 4, now you're up to around about the 60. How would you feel about a VJBL tournament that looked a lot like this?
I think it'd be really cool.
Yeah.
I think it'd be really cool. The Europeans do a really good job of incorporating tournament play into what they do throughout the year. You know, we have our classics and Australia Day tournaments. We do have tournament play here in Melbourne as well. But I think that'd be really, really cool. Where there is actually something on the line, but it does actually paint the whole city. Like, you know, if you did that with, say, the first team of every club in the under-14s, then everyone's got an entry, and you know, it's not just limited to the however many teams make it to the classic or however many teams enroll into the, you know, the Australia Day tournament. So it would be pretty cool, Robbie.
Yeah, and I like
something
the
you
idea.
Can get on top of.
Oh, I'll just knock that out now for you. It's but it would be a cool event. Just one game for everything is fantastic. Like, it's with a lot of these blue blood schools, if you make that a 5-game series, they'll win that. They might drop one game somewhere, but ultimately they're going to win it. I like the idea of a one and done type thing. It's like, well, hey, go win that game. Like, if you're better, go win it.
Absolutely.
I like the idea of upsets.
Absolutely. So. Some pretty cool coaching stories out there as well this weekend. Robbie, Porter Moser at Loyola Chicago, been a long time assistant. He's done a great job with his Loyola Chicago team. John Beilein, he was not long ago not a Division One coach. Like, he was a really good NAIA coach, who's now one of the best coaches in the country, and he lives for the March Madness. As we said, his team just get better and better. Billy Kennedy, head coach of Texas A&M, done an outstanding job. He's had to battle injuries all year, so Texas A&M is loaded. And you would have seen on that North Carolina game yesterday that their athleticism stacked up with North Carolina. He's a fantastic coach. He coached Southeastern Louisiana when I was down in Louisiana. Mm-hmm. Played against him. He had some very good teams in our league down there as well. So,
and interesting that Coach K has managed to find probably the only coach older than him to coach against in his matchup with Syracuse. I think K's maybe 71, and I think Boeheim might be 73.
There'll be 2,000 wins in that game.
It's a lot
on the weekend.
Yep. So that's and the good lesson as well is that it doesn't matter how old you are, you're still valuable to the game as a coach, and there's a lot of experience in that. It's not just a case of, hey, you're too old to coach anymore. Like, there's a lot of value with those guys.
Absolutely, but they evolved. The zone has been there the whole time, but Boeheim's evolved in who he recruits and his offensive philosophies. Coach K, 5 years ago, did not recruit one-and-dones at all. So now he has completely changed his process to recruiting. He's changed his process to how he plays offensively. And even this year, as we spoke about, has incorporated a 2-3 zone into it. So, hey, a few good sets that we saw on the weekend. Loyola ran a really cool hammer set to tie the ball game up late in their game. So that's online. You could just literally type into Google Loyola hammer set and a video would come up, I'm sure of it. John Beilein ran a really cool dribble handoff with a punch screen and then just lifted a shooter out of the opposite post, which had the opposition frantic. And then Duke ran a really cool side on ball where they roll the screener and put him straight into a cross screen. It's usually Marvin Bagley, and they get him a post touch on the opposite block, which is a really good little wrinkle in their side on ball game. So I'm sure there'll be some playbooks and that floating around the internet this week of the best sets of the first weekend of March Madness.
Always, and pickandpop.net do a great job of that as well. It was one of the sets that Buffalo ran against Arizona, which caused them no end of problems for Ayton having to come out and guard the perimeter as well. So it's great to see some of these coaches at their craft that, hey, here's our set, but here's our wrinkles, and here's where we can find a matchup that we can exploit, or we feel like we have an advantage in this situation. Here's what we're going to try and do to use that as well. So I think this is the best time of year to just watch coaches at their craft, and it's some of the best coaches and best players in the world. We can learn a lot from a lot of these coaches too.
And weekend to weekend, like, you'll see wrinkles on this weekend on what they put in last weekend, because now these teams, Texas A&M has got 20 games of film on Michigan. They know every set they're going to run before they even take the floor. So you do have to get a little bit creative. And what does happen at the end of the game is that the best players generally will win. We spoke about that, Robbie. So if you do take value in player development, like all these clubs do, then you do give yourself a chance. So some good games coming up, mate. Sweet 16, yeah. Friday, Saturday
here. It is. So this is probably our last one, given you jet off, I think, this weekend.
Possibly, Robbie. Possibly. I might be able to phone in. Ooh. Phone conference in.
It'll be interesting. Given how you're sitting on the bracket challenge, we may not need you.
Don't need that. Where am I?
Where are you? You're 15th at the moment.
15th?
But the one on your fridge says you're going pretty well.
I'm going all right.
Filling that out after the game.
No one else can see the fridge.
Yeah, exactly right. Exactly right. Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll catch you guys, obviously, on Thursday as well.